started speaking last week about the concept of the hidden world and the revealed world. Let's look a little more deeply at some other aspects of this idea. We tried to say, you're not going to go through the whole subject again, but we tried to explain the idea that the spiritual world and the physical world are on two opposite planes, and that being Jewish means, at rock bottom, being connected to the spiritual world, which means the opposite of being connected to the physical. We try to explain how Western culture and the whole secular environment is only respecting and hyping up the physical dimension, the external world, and how the concept of what we are is not always at internality. We try to show some examples. We try to show that we always take wine. Wine is a mystical representation of the force that connects, that brings out the inner world. That's why the mystics say, when wine goes in, the secret comes out. They try to explain it, means that it liberates the hidden world, not only literally, physically in the person, but it's also mystically. We try to explain it. That's why wine has rules opposite to the rest of the physical world. As the rest of the physical world disintegrates with time, wine gets better with time. We try to look at some of these ideas. We tried also to show that they directly connected. The more one goes up, the more the other goes down. The more physical a person you are, the less spiritual you could possibly be. But the more you work on the body, the less spiritual sensitivity you can have. The perception is if you work on the body as a vehicle for the spiritual content, that's different. If you try and work on the body only as a vehicle, that's very hard to do, because the body claims for itself its own right. But if you could work on the body only as a loyal vehicle for spirituality, then it wouldn't interfere at all. But if you work on the body in the way that the body wants, which means to give it its own pleasure and its own attention, then you can't possibly be spiritual. That's why the Torah pathway is to deny physicality. Not to deny physicality in totality, but to deny physicality as an end in itself. Right? Try to explain, I don't know if it was clear enough, that the difference between Judaism and other spiritual systems is that the way the non-Jewish world functions in spirituality, and it could be that there's a certain element of truth in it, we're not going into that now, but the way the non-Jewish world functions in terms of spirituality is that in order to reach a spiritual level, they have to divorce themselves from the physical. And you'll see that the non-Jewish mind has a special sensitivity to this, if that's what you can call it. That when they wish to reach an elevation, they leave behind the physical, they become ascetics, they live in a cave, they don't get married, they don't... Muslims aren't even allowed to own alcohol. They become completely divorced from the physical world in order to reach a spiritual level. That is a pathway like that. But the Jewish pathway is to get stuck into the physical world and through connection with the physical, right, using it as a vehicle and a springboard to get to the spiritual, and that's the only path that you can use. When a Jew gets involved, the tragedy of a Jew getting involved in an Eastern system, right, the tragedy is that it can't possibly work for a Jewish neshama. It's an amazing thing. You can have a sensation of a high, that the high will only be in the external part of the mind, that the mystic explained. Although it could work for a non-Jewish neshama. Right? And a person could get to certain levels in it, but only in the external world. Because the pathway is geared to transcendence, and there's certain very strong power that has. But the special power of a Jewish neshama is a much harder pathway than that. That's to get involved in the physical, and use the physical as a means of elevation. That's a much greater trick to be able to do that. But I'm not saying that non-Jews have to follow that path. But that's we're talking tonight to try and understand what it is that we're supposed to do. Now, we understand that this idea, all we're trying to do this evening is trying to show how opposite we're supposed to think from the rest of the world. Exactly the opposite. A Jew is supposed to be exactly the opposite of the rest of the world. And unfortunately, how we think exactly like they do. No matter how Jewish you think you are and how frum you think you might be, the tragedy is that we think exactly like they do. We respect what they respect. We admire what they admire. We don't really, even though we might fool ourselves and think that we want to be spiritual, we want to be hidden in the inner world where everything's hidden, actually, that's not where we are. The reasons are many. First of all, we've brought up in that environment. And second of all, it's much harder. The body speaks much louder. The external world, the one that achieves the glory, the one that scores the goals, that gets the recognition, it's a much easier world to feel the thrill in, and therefore there's a much stronger pull in that world. It's a much harder trick to be able to develop the maturity to have pleasure and depth and excitement from a completely hidden dimension. We try to explain this by looking at the idea of adventure, and of various external ethics that the Western world ascribes to that Judaism doesn't even have a word for. Not to mention them last week, Roman, chivalry, etiquette, adventure, things like that you can't find in Torah, because actually those ideas don't exist in the spiritual world. Now, let's try and look at one or two other angles of this. Some of them we've mentioned before in other contexts. Let's try and, some of them many months ago, let's try and put them together and get some new idea for Rosh Hashanah. You see, there are amazing, amazing ideas over here. And the trouble is that even if you get inspired by these ideas, but tomorrow you won't be inspired anymore. Because again, when you wake up tomorrow, the first thing that wakes up is your body. If you're lucky, the neshama will wake up sometime during the day. Actually, most of us, the neshama doesn't. You know, there's an old joke in Jerusalem. People who daven regularly will understand this joke. They say that to have kavanah, that means to really put your mind into the davening. To say the davening, just to spit it out from rote, from memory, that's easy. To put your mind in is very hard. So they ask a question in halacha. Oh, I heard this from a Rosh Yeshiva in Jerusalem. He said, what's the first point in the davening that you have to have kavanah for? What, you know, you follow the question, for those who are not halakhically orientated. It means, which point in the morning prayers, right, in the prayer liturgy, in the davening, what's the first point that you required to have kavanah? Kavanah means intent, you have to know what you mean. You have to intend the words, you have to understand what you're saying. What's the first point in the davening that you have to have kavanah for? The answer is, hayom yom shlishi. In other words, you follow, but I have to explain that, unfortunately, but the psalm of the day, most people, the answer, the first point in the davening you have to have kavanah for is the first pasuk of Shema, or the first verse, the first brach of Shmona Esrei, you follow. The last thing you say in the davening, just before you sign off, is the psalm of the day, but to know which day it is, you follow, you have to have kavanah. But until then, you can be fast asleep, and the tragedy is most of us. The tragedy is that most of the world never ever wakes up at all, as we've mentioned many times. Especially those who think they've woken up. That's the deepest sleep that you could ever. That's a vivid dream. But in this regard, the West is probably better than we are, because they know what they're supposed to be doing, and they're doing it well. The Western world is supposed to be building the external world, and they're doing that well. It's murderous in many ways, but they're doing their job. We are supposed to be developing a hidden world, and we never even know that it exists. All we long for is their world. We never make it in their world, but that's all we long for. We never discover what it is we're supposed to be. If you want to put it in mystical terms, we never discover the woman. We tried to explain last week that the woman is a dimension of hiddenness that brings Kedusha out. That means that gives birth. The male dimension is the one that is able to put inspiration into the world, and it's the one that's able to reap reward and recognition. But it's the woman's dimension. It never gets rewarded, right? Because it does everything in secret. Men won't know what I'm talking about. Women don't have to hear this because they know it already. The only thing women have to know is that they have to feel good about it. Most women are trained in society to feel negative about it, that their job is a hidden one. But what can you do? This talk isn't going to make any difference either. The point is that it's in the hidden world that birth happens, right? The male world can only put the seed or the spark in, but it's the female world where the child can actually grow. Difficult, it's painful, you can't take any time off. It's got all the qualities that a man doesn't have. That's where it is. What it means is that we have to develop the world of the woman, where we have the maturity to understand the hidden depth, and not the superficiality to only respond to the glory, the icing on the top. What this has to do with Rosh Hashanah is as follows. The topic of my voice is going to lock out. Rosh Hashanah is the time when the year is most hidden. We tried to explain this briefly last week, the idea being that the seed of something is when it's most hidden. That's why conception always takes place in private. It always takes place in a hidden dimension. The absorption, the beginning, conception is always something that has to be hidden. It happens always like that. I don't want to get too graphic about it. If you understand anything spiritually and you know how to abstract things from the physical, you understand what I mean. But even if you look in nature, you'll see that when a seed falls into the ground, the place where the seed actually germinates is always hidden underground. And it's always hidden, can you hear me at the back? It's always hidden in such a way that not only is it hidden physically, it happens under the ground, but it happens in a dimension that's hidden from human expectation. That means if you watch the seed, you would see that it detaches itself from the plant, that looks like it's finished, then it falls down onto the ground, and then it buries itself, and if you could see it under the ground, you'd see it begin to disintegrate. And only when the seed begins to fall apart, does new shoots appear from the seed. It always happens at the moment of greatest hiddenness. The new year is formed at the moment of greatest hiddenness. The last month of the year leads to a complete close down. Rosh Hashanah happens in a time that's completely hidden. You know, there are many, many connections with this. You don't blow the shofar, you don't announce the month, there are many things that we keep hidden about Rosh Hashanah because it has to happen. The idea of a new birth, when the conception happens, when the genes are laid down, that happens at Rosh Hashanah time. As we've explained before, when the genes are being formed, that's when everything's formed. We've said this many times. Later on, when the child's being formed, if you damage, right, if a fetus while it's being formed, if you touch a certain part, the child might be born with a dent or a bump or a scar someplace. But if while the genes are being put together, if you touch the smallest molecule of the genes, there's no telling what a grotesque result you might have. It's a much more critical phase. The closer you get to the beginning, the more critical it is. And that's why the day of Rosh Hashanah is a time that's so critical in terms of your development. Whether not only is the shape and form of the year determined by the way you look on Rosh Hashanah, but whether you live or die is determined on that day. It's not some cruel spiritual joke. The idea is that when you're forming the genes, that's the most critical moment. Again, it's very hard to be graphic, but it says that when a child is formed, what's in the mind of the parent forms the totality of that child. And there's descriptions of certain things that parents can do mentally that cause certain deformities in children. Again, it's very hard to go into here. You have to do it some other time. We have to get women to speak to the women and men to speak to the men. But that's got to do with the concept that the most rarefied and abstracted moment of conception, that's when everything is laid down all at once. Right? The rest of the year, you've got time to make corrections and to go back and to work on things slowly. But in the moment of conception, you don't have any time. You shrink down to an instant that's above time, before time begins. But in that transcendent, infinite instant, that's when everything happens all at once. It's remarkable. The only way to be ready for that, the only way to get that right, is to be prepared beforehand. There's no time to work it out when you're there. You follow me? While you're working out, if you like, while the fetus is being formed, while the child's being formed internally, you could say that's the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So there you've got 10 days, you can work on it. You've probably got a few minutes every day to think about what it is you're doing that day as you work on each of the 10 mystical dimensions. But at the moment of conception, the day of Rosh Hashanah, that instant in time, there's almost no time to work on it. The whole day has to be perfect. That is why, one of the ideas, you know, in Rosh Hashanah we have a thing called, an issue of remembrance. We remember. You know that the Hebrew word should be apparent from everything we've said up to now, should be able to put a lot of ideas together. Think about it for a few minutes, you'll see that the Hebrew word for remember is zachar. Zachor. You with me? Zikaron, zachar. That's the root, zachar. It's remarkable that the same word in Hebrew means male. Isn't that remarkable? Because the same root, the concept of being male, the male doesn't do anything in birth. The woman does everything. All the male does, he brings the seed from one generation to the next. That's all he does. The male, what does he do? Where does the male seed? What happens when a child's born? The male distills his whole being into an infinite seed, and that seed gives the woman everything she needs to produce a child. It's a remarkable thing. So all he is a flash of memory. That's all the male is. You follow? He remembers what he got from the previous generation, genetically, as it were. You follow? Spiritually. Condenses it down into an infinite wisp of almost nothingness. And from that, you follow? Remarkable in Hebrew, if you work it out, you'll see that Zikaron adds up to the same number of letters as Zera, as a seed. A memory and a seed equals exactly what a seed. What is a seed? A seed is a shapeless, faceless, nameless blob of nothingness, an acorn. But inside it is a memory of the whole tree. And not only that, but it's a memory of all the trees that ever were like that tree. And not only that, but a memory of all the intention of all those trees to be able to produce the same kind of tree to infinity. That's a remarkable thing. That's what a seed is. That's what a memory is. That's what a male is. No one's running down men over here. Follow me. It's just that in terms of the hidden dimension, that's the idea of Rosh Hashanah. That you get into the level called the seed, the head of something. Everything is conceived on that day. The flash takes place. It's a lightning flash that ignites everything. You have to be ready for Rosh Hashanah. Now, let's look at an idea. We said we were going to try and look at where we're different from the rest of the world. Again, you have to be very careful. We're not here to knock Western culture. Again, that's not our purpose. There's no point in it. We're not going to make any difference to them. But the point is, you have to understand why we're not there. That's what we do have to understand. So we do have to look at it a little bit in order to understand what we are. Right? Although it's not our direct purpose, like our Avigdor Miller says, you don't move into a new house to kill cockroaches, but you've got to do it. I think that's not going to do it. So that's the idea. That's the idea. So let's understand why we're different and what's going on over there. Now, what we try to express is this. Again, it's an almost impossible battle to try and explain these things, because you'll see that the mechanisms we have for understanding these things are all perverted. The mechanisms we have for understanding these things are their minds. What we have inside our heads are their minds. We have non-Jewish, I'm talking about frum people, never mind people who think they're Westerners. I'm talking about frum people who think they're Jewish. What we have in our minds, no matter if it's Israeli or not Israeli, it makes no difference. What we have in our minds is a non-Jewish, Western, technological, external view of things, and we filter Judaism, we filter Torah Yiddishkeit through that external mind. It's an impossibility. It's a nace. As my Rebbe said, it's a nace that anybody could hear any Torah, but we're lucky to have such a nace that you have to try. You have to move to be on a level of a miracle to hear such things in depth and understanding. Because our measure and our criteria and our values are going to be definitely what we got from the, what we imbibed with a mother's milk on the lap of Western culture. What can we do? We have to try and understand. If you look at it, you'll see that every thing you can choose in Western thinking, you'll see is the opposite of what Jesus Christ understands. We can't go through all of them, but let's just take a few ideas that are worth detailing. Again, let's just be clear that we're not criticizing here. We are criticizing only the fact that we think we're supposed to be doing their job. You follow me? There's nothing wrong with being a man or being a woman is fine, but when one tries to be what the other one is, that's when you have problems. Okay? The non-Jewish world is given a special gift and power to develop certain aspects of the external world. There's nothing wrong with that. They were set up with that as a divine task. Whether they're doing it correctly or not is not our debate right now. We're certainly not doing what we're supposed to be doing before we start looking at whether they're doing their job correctly. No question about that. We're not going to criticize again, that must be clear. But we just have to look at what it is that they build up, how they relate to things, and how we relate to things and how we should relate to things. You'll see, if you take the way they conceptualize the world, you'll see that Torah attitude always is opposite. Give an example. The non-Jewish world always admires what they call progress. They always see themselves as on the way up in every facet of their thinking. They think that the more modern is the more ideal, right? They think they're getting closer to perfection. They see it in technology. Right? There's an expansion, exponential explosion in technological advancement. They see that. They see their capability in terms of mind power, in terms of perception, in terms of what they can do in the world, in terms of where they can stretch themselves out to. They see it in terms of their own being. The way they think about things is that they were once monkeys. That's what they think about the world. And now they are highly developed, highly intelligent species called man. That's the way they see things. And the whole culture is based on that kind of a spectrum. Jewish thinking is exactly the opposite. We understand that we're going disastrously downhill. Right? Disastrously downhill. We come from a place that was an electric experience called Matan Torah, where we electrified our blood, was set alight with spiritual fire at that time. We saw all the spiritual dimensions clearly. No human ever got to that level. The Jews who stood at Sinai reached the level of Adam Rishon before the Chet. That means the ideal infinite human who was created before the world condensed even into this physical form. That's the level they got to. An absolutely supernal dimension. And from there we started going down. Not only are we going downhill, but we're in the exponential phase now. The mystics say that the last few years before the coming of Mashiach, which is now, is an exponential decline. That's what we're doing now. We don't see ourselves. They see themselves having come from monkeys and getting higher, higher, higher. You know, I think the Tzaddik of Kelm put it this way. He said that a non-Jew thinks, why does a non-Jew think that his forefathers were monkeys? Because he looks around at the world and that's what he sees. He looks around at his father and he sees what the general conduct was of the secular world and its ethic and its brutality. He sees what it was. He looks back to his grandfather's generation and he sees worse than that. So he thinks originally it must have been monkeys. But a Jew, he looks back at his father's generation and he sees them as transcendent, sainted individuals. They struggled with ordeals we can't even begin to imagine, and they retained a spirituality that we can't begin to understand. And the grandfathers, our grandfather's dimension was totally beyond our understanding. And if you go back to the days where we showed him, right, we're in a totally transcendent world that we can't begin. So we think that if you go back far enough, it must have been Malachim. You follow? That's a logical, but it stems from a world view which sees things proceeding in opposite planes. Now, if you think about this for a moment, you'll see that there's a core and a reason for this. You see, you have to speak about these things clearly. If you don't defect them out clearly, so you get a cholent of ideas in your head, you think that we have great forefathers, it's true, you have such an unkosher mixture. You think that you have great forefathers who are saints and prophets, that you know. On the other hand, you know that the Western world teach you that in those days they were cavemen. Is that correct? If you go back to the generation where we're talking about prophets and Matan Torah, so the same Matan Torah that we're talking about angelic beings who are so transcendent you couldn't begin to look at them. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he came down from the mountain, he was so alive with spiritual power that the people of his generation couldn't bear to look at him. If one of those individuals walked into this room now, we would dissolve. We would absolutely dissolve in a puddle. But we wouldn't be able to stand to look at their greatness, their bright intensity spiritually. Literally, they're not being poetic over here. Literally, that's what it would be. On the other hand, if you go back in history to that generation, they were aboriginals living in caves, bashing each other over their head for a living. That's what they were doing at that time. And the Jewish mind has got some kind of challenge of all these ideas together, where we think they were primitive, they were barbaric, on the other hand, they were saintly. But it's such a mixture of ideas, it's difficult to understand how we ever even conceive ourselves. Remarkable thing. But if you think about it carefully, you'll see that the reason for this confusion is as follows. The dimension that we want to look at is like this. If you understand that we function in the inner world, and they function in the external world, you'll understand everything. Understand. You see, whenever we have an enemy, whenever we have an ideology or an enemy, physical or idealistic, ideological, we always understand there's some truth in what they do, right? We're not dealing with fools. Torah doesn't have time for willful, evil-minded people and for fools. We're not dealing with a culture that doesn't make any sense at all. We understand that these people, if they a match for the greatness that the Jewish people are supposed to have, and our enemies have always been as great as we are, then we understand there has to be some truth in what they do. It has to be a subtle ivut, distortion of what the truth is. That's what it has to be. So what's the truth in what they say? What's the truth in the system? Why are they so wrong? Where's the rightness in it? The rightness, the correctness is this, that what they perceive is the external world, and in the external world they're right. In the external world there's tremendous progress. In the external world there's no question about it. The external world is developing tremendously. There are mystical sources written 2,000 years ago that say, listen to this, if this doesn't sum it up, mystical sources written 2,000 years ago that say this. Today, speaking then, today, it takes 3 months to go from Rome to Jerusalem, but there'll come a day when it'll take 3 hours. That's what it said then. Which means that there's an exponential increase in physical, technological power. That was foreseen then. But spiritually, we should know that what will happen is exactly the opposite. The inner dimension of the world, human integrity, concepts like loyalty, human decency, what it means to stand up for the dignity of being human, that's going to go down at the same rate, exactly at the same rate, as the external world is going to go up. Right? And you see it clearly. The reason that we perceive the world as going down, not because we're blind to technological advance, but we see it also. We appreciate for what it is. We use it. We're not against it. But the point is that what they sell is the external shell. They sell us everything. Like we tried to explain last week. They take romance and they sell it as love. You follow? We don't do that. We take love and we sell it as love. It's dressed up in a material, temporary thing called romance to give it a bit of a push in the beginning. That's all. The vehicle only. Well, they take the vehicle, the shell, the external dimension, and they sell that as everything. That's where the problem arises. But if you understand that they're two separate worlds, you'll understand clearly that they're quite correct. That what they're developing and working on in the world, and as it explodes exponentially, you should know, it's an indication. It's an exact meter. It's an exact meter. If you want to know how quickly the world is degenerating spiritually, you have to look exactly at the pace, the exponential phase of the curve that the world's developing in technologically, that's how bad it's becoming spiritually. You want to know how much we resemble, listen well, you want to know how much we resemble what it means to be human, huh? Compared to just one generation ago, all you have to think about is the difference, the percentage increase in technology that's been made in the last 50 years, compared to the 50 years before that, there's no comparison at all. There's no comparison at all. What could people do 50 years ago technologically? They were just beginners, raw, rank beginners, right? Compared to what's been done, what has been done in the history of the listen world, what has been done in the history of the world, the whole entire human history until 50 years ago, right, has many times been done over in the last 6 months in terms of advancement. No question about it. You follow? You're exponential. Well, that's what's happened spiritually. If you want to know what's happened spiritually, at least that bad exactly what they call peripatria has gone down, that we've degenerated that way. If you want to get a feel for it, let's try and get a feel for it in one of the areas. The best example I can give, I've used this before in another context, just to try and give you a slight indication. It's very difficult to get a feel for these things. But as South Africans, we can begin to get a slight feel in the following way. Again, it might not work for you, this example, but if you're clear about what's happening in this country and who you are, what your family is and means, you'll be able to see a remarkable thing. I'm just choosing this as an example, the best I can think of at the moment. The best example is to look at Torah history, which most of us don't have enough insight into. The best example is to understand what the Torah greatness of today is and compare to the Chofetz Chaim was. You understand what light years of difference there are over there and how he spoke about his Rebbe in that way. So you'll understand that we're nothing now. Nothing, less than nothing now. But if we don't, if you've never read the works of the Chofetz Chaim, and you've never seen what he is compared to the Rambam, you never have a chance to study the Rambam and see it firsthand, you won't understand it. But let's take something that's a much weaker indication, but much closer to ours. If you begin, but at a certain age, this is going to be meaningless. Okay? You have to take it from me. Look at what's happened in South Africa. But let's take an example. Let's take an example of what it means just to have the inner togetherness of being called human. Let's just take the consciousness of a person walking around today. Don't have to be Jewish for this, by the way. But you see, especially strongly in the Jewish community. The consciousness of what it means to have the integrity of a human being. How complete you feel as a human being of integrity compared to what the emotion and reality was of the integrity and intensity, loyalty, and all the human qualities of just one generation ago in this country. And I assure you, and you can check it out in Torah history, that that was nothing compared to what it was one generation before that. And that was not, and it goes up exponentially like that. But just feel it in one or two generations. You'll see that if you take any aspect of human living, you'll see that what we are compared to our parents, looking personally now, look at your own family. And if your parents didn't make it into this category, then certainly your grandparents. You compare the generation that came over in South Africa from Europe. The Lithuanian generation that came over here, certainly that generation, maybe your grandparents, in some cases great-grandparents. But those people, you compare them, right, what they were, to, never mind Torah observance, you're not talking about that, ignoring the fact that there was a generation that didn't keep, did what our Torah and Shmira submitted. We're talking about people who didn't do that. We're not talking about great Torah sages who maintained everything. We're talking about a generation that came over here and dropped all that, didn't keep mitzvahs anymore. They didn't keep Shabbos. But compare what they were as raw human beings in terms of decency and integrity to what the man in the street around you is today. Now, two generations removed, one generation or two, what do you see? Well, it's too long to even discuss tonight, but go home and think about it. You'll see that generation, talking about you, people who today are 70, 80 and above, right? That generation, certainly, and the generation before them. You'll see that it was a world in which, and it's reflected in the general world, you can expand what I'm saying to the business world in general in this country, overseas, it makes no difference. But here you can feel it personally. You'll see that what a human being represented over then was a mensch. In every way, he was a person of loyalty and integrity and decency. His outer world was a world of dignity. In the most superficial way, his inner world, nobody ever broke his... Think back to your grandparents. Could you ever think of ever hearing of anybody among his social circle that ever broke his word? Can you think of an example? I can't think of an example among my parents and their friends, that they ever broke an arrangement. If you had an arrangement, you didn't break it. Were you ever broke your word in business? Was a contract ever necessary? Did anybody ever go back on what they said? Did anybody ever do any less than the maximum intense self-sacrifice for their children? Do you follow? Loyalty to everything, loyalty to Judaism. What was intermarriage like in that generation? It was almost unheard of. It was scandalous. It happened, but it was very rare. Divorce. Divorce was almost unheard of in the Jewish community 2 generations ago. And I'm talking about marriages that weren't happy. In many cases when a marriage had fallen off from being a Torah-inspired marriage, the marriages weren't happy. I've seen it personally in my professional capacity. That people in that generation often stuck together with no spark of love or emotion left from many, many, many years before. But they stayed together. They stayed together. There was no concept of just upping and leaving somebody. What kind of disloyalty brings people into the world? What kind of disloyalty is it? I'm not saying that divorce isn't sometimes necessary. It's often the better option. But only because the world's fallen to what it's fallen to. Only because people have reached a stage now with not even a concept of loyalty. What happened to what you said 5 years ago? You stood there and said that you committed your life no matter what would happen to this person. What happened to that? He just forgot about that after 25 years of marriage? Or 35 years of marriage? There was a generation in the world's history when if a person did that, he'd rather be dead. There was a generation in the history of the world where among the non-Jews, in the non-Jewish world 150 years ago, in the late 1800s, there was an ethic in the world that if a person ever broke his word, he committed suicide. If an officer in the British Army ever was shown to have been a fraction less integrity, loyalty, commitment to what he said he would do, to his principles, and was expected of him, he went out and shot himself. It was the most dignified action he could do. There's no question. It wasn't worth being alive after that. You with me? In the Prussian army, in the Russian army, in the German army, in German society, in European society, in brutal societies, loyalty and dignity was worth more than a man's life. Today, who even takes it seriously? Are you with me? I mean, you can go on and on about it. Look at that generation, you'll see that their external dignity. People had a certain dignity about, they dressed with a certain dignity. Right? If you went out someplace, 20 years ago even, you went out someplace, you dressed for the occasion. Then it showed a certain self-image. Today you wear some kind of sack that's got somebody's advert written across the top. Right? That's what you do. That's a shapeless form that doesn't have to be clean anymore. Right? I mean, you could go on and on. But if you look back, you'll see that the dimension of integrity and intensity, and those people, by the way, if they would hear this conversation, they think we're strange to talk this way because then it was completely normal. They never considered breaking your word or changing or letting anyone down or saying something that you didn't mean. It was just a normal aspect of society. That's what Jews were. And you should hear them speak about their parents in terms of how their parents managed to maintain all that in the face of tremendous adversity, in the face of poverty and starvation. They maintained standards much higher than that. Adherence to Torah values when it meant death. It's all very well maintaining your integrity and decency in South African society 50 years ago. But their parents did that when it meant death. In Eastern Europe, the people who came over will tell you that their parents told them that if a Jew used to say, there was a well-known statement, that if a Jew, a Lithuanian and a Pole, Polish Jews used to say that if I walk past a non-Jew in the street and he doesn't kill me, it's because he's lazy. That's what they used to say. That was the world they lived in. They didn't say that as a joke, they meant it literally. And life was worth nothing. And through that, then they stuck to Torah values. And you should hear how they spoke about their parents. And I hope the message is clear. I mean, now, so you see that in terms of personal values, you see we're heavily on the way down. Another way to look at it, again, I don't want to label the point, but another way of looking at it is, and it's a sad fact, I don't bring you here to make it depressed, but to show you the reality of the situation and how much tickling we need. If you think about it, if you look around you, at your own home, your own family, your own home, and the closest neighbors, not the closest people, you'll see that there's hardly a home today where somebody isn't there. You'll see that. What can I say? Go down the nearest street to you, kick off the homes one after another. You'll see here's somebody who's married out. Here's somebody who's sexual identity crisis. Right? The next person's father's a medium and he's into who knows what kind of weird and wonderful anti-Jewish, non-Jewish spiritual type of thing. Here's somebody, right? There's hardly a home today. There's hardly a home. Today it's a major achievement. I've said this many times. It's a major, major credit and achievement. If you have a family today, it's just basically normal. Not inspired, not idealistic, just basically normal. The father and mother are still together after 20 years of age, and the children are basically same. The children are still home and basically same. They don't hate each other. And there's no overt violence in the family. Never mind inspired and doing well and achieving, just basically holding together with humanity. It's a major, major achievement today. That's where we hold. So our concept is that the world is degenerating tremendously. The inner world, which is the one that matters to us, is exponentially on the way down. The external world, which is the one that matters to them, and unfortunately, we measure ourselves. Who cares about all this? Who even thought about this before? Talk about the spiritual world and where it's all going down. Who even concerned about all that? What we concerned about, how much of the external world do we have? That's what we think about. That's not Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah time, you've got to think about how much of the internal. The internal world's the only real one. When the external world disintegrates, and it happens to everybody, when that external world disintegrates, then the only thing that's left is the internal world that you built. That's the one you have to work on. I know I'm upsetting a lot of people. The problem here, of course, and the pain, is that there are people around who have more of a sense of inner dignity than others. And sometimes those people trust themselves to others. Very often it's women. Very often it's women who have a deeper sense of the inner world because they tune to it, like we tried to explain. They trust themselves to somebody who's much more good to the external world. That person doesn't have the maturity and they get. That's usually the way it is. I'm not saying that women are blameless. I mean, if women would have maintained their dignity and their hold on the values that they should have, they could have brought them in right. And they're going to have to do that still. Women are going to have to do that. They're still going to have to force the men to reach what they should be. But we've spoken about that. Now, you're not too depressed to continue? We first got to know our values, right? We've got to know where we're holding before we could lift ourselves up. Like, if we think we're doing okay, we're not going to improve. Now, let's look at the next level. Let's look at this in a more spirited idea. Let's take a look at Western society, Western, what they call culture. Let's look at Western culture. Let's try and understand something. I want to share with you an amazing idea. Again, we discussed this about a year ago in another context, but let's look at it more closely. You see, as the listen well now, this fascinating, wonderful idea, I heard this from a very great man, and it bears tremendous amplification. I can't go through it all. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the expansion. I'm not strong in Western culture. It's not one of my... I just don't happen to know too much about it. But I'll lay out the basic outline for you. I'm sure there are people here who are much more skilled in schools in Western culture, arts and music and poetry and stuff than I am, which is a tragedy, because we shouldn't be more knowledgeable about that than about Jewish people. People can tell you who wrote which piece of music and in which date it was written and all the details about the musical score. They never heard of the Ramban, or the Reed. That's what Jews are coming to. It's a shame. It's a burning disgrace. No question. The music that this wrote was much more beautiful, I can say. No question. What the Ramban wrote, the music, the melody was much more beautiful. No question. That's a great country. But again, I'm not strong in this. But if you look at a basic development of Western thought, you'll see a remarkable thing. I want to share with you the following idea. I've put across an idea to you this evening. Let's try and see if we can see indications of it. Let's try and trace it and see if it's correct. When you look at the external world, you see the things that are there. Look at technology, science, advancement in all the technical ways of handling and manipulating the world, you'll see what I've said is true. There's no question about it. Let's try and look at the measuring tool. Let's take a thermometer and put it into the heart. Let's try and look into the hidden depths. Yeah? Let's try and look, it's not only them, of course, it's us, like I said before. But let's try and put our finger in and feel what it feels like inside. Now, where can we get an indication of what that world looks like on the inside? That means they're building a wonderful shell, okay? This shell is expanding tremendously in complexity, like we've explained. Let's see if we can get an insight into the core. Where's the hidden dimension? Are you with me? Where's that hidden world that I'm talking about all the time that we're supposed to be aware of? What's happening to them? Let's look into this culture around us. Let's look into the hidden dimensions. You follow me? Let's see if they reveal it anywhere. And let's see what it indicates. With me. The place where you'll find that indicated is where human beings give vent to their internal dimension. Okay? Science is a manipulation of the world. It's giving vent to the structure of the mind in a certain way. But if you want to look at where the heart comes out, you've got to look at art, music, you follow me, poetry, you've got to look at where humans are expressing their internal, their deepest feelings. Let's look over there and see what happens. Are you with me? Let's see if we can use that as an indication of what's happening. It's a remarkable, remarkable thing. Now, before we understand this subject, we'll need one introduction. Introduction is as follows. What we're going to do now, I hope it's not too complex, stay with me. We're going to take an inner feeling, inner core, and we're going to try and see where it manifests on the outside. Okay? We're going to see where they give expression to it, and we're going to try and be psychologists. We're going to try and see what you can say about the external structure and what it means about the hidden core, because the two always reflect each other. Stay with me. When a person expresses his internal feelings in an external medium, there's an axiom in spiritual thinking. There's an axiom in Musa. You don't have to be too spiritual for this. It's an axiom in Musa that the expression of it in the external world always is in harmony with the expression of it in the internal world. People who were here about a year ago, remember we discussed this in some detail. Let's try and look at it. That means there's always a reverberation or harmony between your inner experience and the way it manifests on the outside and the way you perceive the world. The way you give to the world and the way you perceive the world. Let me try and give you an example. I heard this also from Professor from Gatsby. He put it this way. I want to show you that, and you all know this, but this has to be spoken out to get in touch with it. You'll see that when you have an emotion inside, according to what your emotion is, that's what you'll see on the outside. That's how you'll perceive the outside. I'll give you an example. Person's going on a train. Taking a train, right. Now, you know there's a rhythm in the train. I don't know. There's a rhythm. Kickity-kick, kickity-kick, kickity-kick. That's a rhythm. That is a certain rhythm, a certain harmony that you experience inwardly. Where does that connect with your personality? How does that rhythm connect with you, with your personality? So it depends on what's happening to you inwardly. If you're going on holiday, and you're relaxed, and everything's beautiful and fine with the world, it's the most beautiful sound. It's in perfect harmony with your emotions, it's the most soothing sound, and it's wonderful. And you couldn't hear enough of it. But if you're traveling on a train to a hated destination, to a place that you love, and the closer you get, the more anxious you get, it's the most fearsome sound. It drives you crazy. It's a mockery of who you are. You follow? You have experienced that. Why? Because when you're in inner harmony, listen well, when you're in inner harmony, so then an outer harmony, an outer structure, reverberates in perfect time with the inner harmony, and you feel a sense of harmony. But when you're in inner disharmony, you follow, when you're broken inside, and things are shattered, then you're mocked by an external rhythm, by an external structure. You follow me? And you can't stand it. The two clash with each other. Another example. You with me? Another example. This one comes home from work one day. And he's had a wonderful day. Everything went right. He made wonderful deals. And everything was just fantastic. And he walks into the living room. And there around the dining room table, all the chairs are perfectly in place. There's just one a little bit out of place. So he'll walk up and he'll just push that chair into place. Right? But if he comes home from the office and he's had a terrible day, everything's gone wrong. And as he walks in, the house is in perfect order. He'll walk up to that table and he'll kick everything out of place. Right? You follow? Because you can't stand to see harmony when there's in a... clear. You're with me? Now, is this principle clear? It's a remarkable tool to be able to experience how you're feeling. If you don't know how you're feeling or how together you are, take a look at how you respond to structure, how you respond to harmony in the external world, and a remarkable indicator... Of course, most of us are shattered. And we just don't feel any harmony. Anywhere we don't see harmony. Outside, everything's a mockery. Yeah, most of us walking around in permanent depression. That's, as I said, that's a little bit. But if you have a moment where you're not totally depressed, then take a look at this tool and see what it could do. Now, use this idea. Let's use this idea. Let's see what they express. Let's see what the world expresses in terms of its inner feeling as it reflects itself in outer harmony. You with me? Let's see if they're in accord or in discord. Let's see. You'll see a remarkable. Now, if what I'm saying is true, it should be that as history moves on, so the inner discord grows greater. You with me? In secular society also. In Jewish society and in non-Jewish society. The discord, the fragmentation, the disintegration increases with time. You with me? As their technology gets better, so the inner harmony, the human value, the inner melody, yeah? The inner connection, the inner rhythm and structure, that disintegrates. Where will you see this expressed? You'll see it in art, music, poetry, and all the arts. Let's check it out. Let's check it out. Take interior decorating, for example. I once heard the following thing. A great rabbi told me that he once went on a tour. He lives in England. He lives in Gateshead. And he told me that he once went on a tour of the Lake District. You know, there's a very beautiful district in England. He went on a tour of the Lake District. And on this tour, they took him to see Wordsworth House. It's a monument today. Preserved as a monument, and you can see the house where Wordsworth worked in the Lake District where he wrote some of his greatest poetry. He said he had the following experience. He walked into the, what they call the drawing room of this house, and the guy showed them, you see a very ornate, you know the style, Victorian, or I'm not an expert in history, whatever it was, pre-Victorian times, you see this very, very ornate and structured drawing room. And as you walk through the door, the guy points out to you a door in the opposite wall. It's exact replica of this door here. Okay? As you look at the door you just come through, you see a very ornate gilt door frame. And in the wall opposite, exactly facing this door is an identical door. But that door's a fake. That door's a fake. It doesn't open. Why is it there?
Because it was inconceivable to furnish a room in those days that wasn't symmetrical. You follow me? It was inconceivable to furnish a room that had a door one side that never matched the door the other side. It couldn't stand to live in a room that didn't have perfect symmetry. You follow? Now today, if you don't live in a room where the one wall's purple and the other wall's got green spots, you follow, and they don't match, you wouldn't stand it today. You follow me? Today, who would, is there anybody today? The idea is abhorrent to us to put a fake door in a wall so it should match this wall. You understand what's going on? But that was as, look at the poetry of those days. Look, go further back. Look at Shakespearean poetry. You'll see that every single example of poetry from Shakespeare's day, his own poetry and anybody else who wrote at that time, was perfectly structured. It didn't stand a chance. It would be laughed out of the Globe Theatre if it wasn't perfectly structured. It was and not only perfectly structured, by the way, but so rhythmical that today it sounds a bit strange. Da 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 da. You know, it's like boring today. Iambic pentameter, right? And every line causes a break in the structure or the rhythm. And there's no exception. There's no exception. If you look at poetry, again, I'm not strong on this, you probably know better than I do. But if you go back prior to that time, to Gregorian period, you'll find that the Gregorian chant, when music began, was a rhythmic chant. Poetry at that time. Compare it to the evolution of poetry as it arrives in the modern day. Today, open any book of poetry. You know what you'll see? Any book of modern poetry, you'll find there are no capital letters, first of all. There's no beginnings of the lines. The lines are written all over the place. Gives you a schwindel to look at, right? There's no punctuation. Am I right? Okay? What's going on? You know, there's a chap called Sassoon. I hate to even quote his name because... Actually, that's a Jewish family, so... But, a great Jewish family. But, he wrote a poem describing the emotions of a soldier in the trenches in the First World War. It's called Over the Top. You know, Over the Top meant the terror of a soldier having to come over the lip of the trench and run into enemy fire. And he was one of the first to write a poem where the lines are long and then there's a short line. Then there's a broken line. You follow? What he's describing to you is the gunfire and the emotions of the soldier in the trench about to face death, the disharmony that he's experiencing that comes through in the line. But today all poetry is like that. Correct. Look, for example, at art. Again, you can probably come up with much better illustrations of this principle than I can. But if you look at art, you know, there was a time when a painting of a bowl of fruit looked like a bowl of fruit. There was such a time. Not that long ago. With the skill of a painter, 400 years ago, the skill of a painter was to capture reality exactly. To capture it exactly and to show its inner glow. That was the skill. What happened? Not that long ago. I'm trying to explain the exponential drop. That lasted for centuries. In one form or another, we've given more expression to one or other element that lasted for centuries. For the history of the world, basically. For the history of the world, go back as long as you care to in art. You'll see that to be true. Recently, 100 years ago, I don't even want to quote the names of these movements. Anyone who studied art will know about it. There was a movement where structure began to break down. You know what I'm talking about. And the whole ethic was to show disjointed structure. Not only that, but that movement went with tremendous grotesque behavior patterns. I don't know, you know what I'm talking about. These people, the modern rock concerts, where the music is secondary to the enormity of the obscenities that take place, especially in the late 60s, early 70s, right? That was when it began. These people actually conducted themselves with tremendous grotesque obscenity that went along with the art to show a disdain for society because there was a fracture between the inner and outer expressions in society. But that got worse. From that time on, art disintegrated. Today, if anybody paints a painting of an exact representation, somebody today, yeah, 20 years ago, paints a painting that looks exactly like a tomato can, that tomato's a sensation. You follow? That's a sensation. It looks like a photograph, it's a sensation. That's unheard of in art. You follow? Never, the whole painting, all it does is, it looks exactly what it's supposed to look like, and the person's a hero. It's so unusual. You follow me? You know what I'm talking about? Because that is an art. And of course, you know what modern art becomes. Not even disjointed, it's just not even anything. And modern art, what do they call it now? Situation art or something. What's it called? What? No, there's this other thing where you... exhibition consists of the artist standing on one foot and switching on a shower tap or something. What's it called? I don't know, there's such a... Right? Follow me. Or he takes his... He gets his cat to run across the canvas. He electrifies it. He dips the cat in paint. He does it with tremendous kavona. You follow? Right? And he's a hero, makes millions from that kind of thing. Trace the development of music. If you trace the development of music, you'll see the same thing. Music. Music until the classical period. Again, I'm not strong on it, but music until the classical period was perfectly, perfectly structured. If you go through any Bach piece, Bach was the beginning of what we understand as modern music. Before that, it was all perfectly structured, much less complex. But if you go through Bach, Vivaldi, again, I don't want to mention all the names. You go through, and I'm not knowledgeable about it, but if you go through that phase, you'll see that the measure of perfection then was structured. Look at a fugue, a Bach fugue. You'll see that the measure of its perfection was how closely, you know what's considered the greatest symphony ever written, the greatest classical symphony ever written is a certain Mozart symphony, and its greatness is because it observes the rules of what a classical symphony should be most accurately. That's its greatness. You follow? It's remarkable. What happened after the classical phase? Became the romantic phase. The romantic phase was already more free expression. It was perfectly structured. Take any symphony that's what's known as a romantic. At the post-classical phase, you'll find it was tremendously structured, but it had more inner feeling, and after that, an exponential breakdown. What happened after that was a movement of people who began music that was so atonal that Stravinsky was one of the first people who began to compose atonal music. What he was doing was exactly, you think it's a coincidence? Do you think it's a coincidence that in all these forms of human expression, you see a pathway into disintegration and disorder? You have to be blind to think that it's just a phase. Just somebody got into his head and everybody started copying. You follow? You have to be crazy to think such a thing. You have to understand what it means internally. The world's telling you something. You have to understand what an expression of depth it is. Stravinsky, when he wrote his first famous atonal piece, I think it was called The Light of Spring, or Afternoon of the Fall, I don't know. When it was played in Paris for the first time, you know what atonal music is? Instead of being based on the semitone scale like we use, which has a tonic, dominant, and subdominant, where the music evokes from you a sense of rhythm, right? You follow? When you hear the subdominant note, your body demands to hear the dominant. You follow? You demand to hear that final chord. It evokes a system. Right? Stravinsky composed his first piece on a whole tone scale, which doesn't have any relationship between the notes, not that same relationship that speaks to the body. It doesn't have the same structure, like Eastern music. But he composed an atonal kind of a system. When it was first played in Paris, he had to be escorted from the auditorium by the police because the audience tried to kill him. You follow me? They literally tried to take his life, right, because he dared to offend them with such nonsense. But it later, shortly after that, became accepted. It became the in thing when the audience slightly degenerated, you follow, a little bit further, till they were all atonal themselves. So then they could think. And today, of course, at least that was descriptive. If you listen to one of the atonal pieces of that period, it's atonal, and it doesn't appeal to the ear in terms of rhythm, but it certainly describes what he tried to describe. It describes the flight of a fawn in the forest. It certainly describes what he was trying to describe. No question about it. But today, it doesn't describe anything. Today, the modern, you know what the highlight of this is today? The chap, I don't know if you know, they write music now on disconnected stage, they hang him from a mobile, and as it turns in front of him, he plays what he sees. You follow? That's it. The artist, the pianist, yeah, hang a thing from a string, and as the bars turn, he plays what he sees. They've gone one step better than that, which is put a cat on the piano, and as the poor cat tries to get off, they sit in rapt attention, you follow? Listen to the meaning of it. That's what it is. And you can follow the same thing through the art, through literature, through drama, music, painting, etc., sculpture, you'll see that's what it is. Now, what it means to us, right, is that we can have a little fun also, not only get the best. Understand. But you have to understand what it means to a Jew. Again, we're not criticizing. I'm not here to give you a critique on modern art, if it's art, if it isn't art, if it's good, if it's bad, if it deserves to be paid millions. I'm not here for that. I have no opinion about it. And it's not relevant. But we're trying to use it as an indication of what is going on inside. Let's look at one final Torah idea. You realize the tragedy. Again, the tragedy is not that they do this. It's the tragedy that they've done that to us, that we've allowed. That's the way we think. That's where we hold it. Let's try and understand the correction. The correction is the following. I'll finish with this idea. One of the most beautiful ideas you'll ever hear. And it's as follows. I heard this recently. I was amazing. It was an amazing experience for me. But listen to this pshat in pasuk. We're just going to take a pasuk from the Torah, from Tanakh. Let's take a commentary, a medrash that talks about this verse, and let's just understand how the Torah has insight into the inner world and the outer world. Right? Just try and tie together everything we've said, that the inner world has all the opposite rules of the outer world. Right? As the one expands, the other one contracts. They're in direct opposition to each other. Everything we've said over the last 2 weeks, let's try and put it together with this idea. That outer world is called Esav. That external world is called Esau, the Esau world, the Esav world. Esav was a man of physical power. That was who he was. Brute. He was powerful. He looked like Yaakov. They were twins, don't forget. But he developed the external world and it ran away with him. He got it stuck into the external world for its own right, for its own sake. Right? He didn't do it as a vehicle. Right? The highest dimension was connected to it. That's why it says when he died, he was decapitated. You know, Esav died at the entrance to the Machpelah. He was decapitated, killed by Hushim ben Dan, who was deaf. I also want to go into the Medrash. He was killed. And as he died, his body fell to the ground and his head rolled into the Machpelah and was buried there. That means the head of Esav is buried together with Adam, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. The head of Esav, you follow? The pnimius, the head, the control dimension of the external world, that's where it belongs. It's a remarkable thing. That's what it means. It's not an accident, you follow, that his head rolled in and they left it there. That's what it means. But that external world is Esav. The body of Esav belongs outside. The body of Esav has only power, only physical power, but no internal connection, no depth inside. Listen to this. Pasuk says the following thing. And of course the inner world is Yaakov. Yoshev or Halev, he sits in tents. In the inner world, he sits in a tent, a home, a house. A house is called a woman. The hidden world, that's where he sits. Listen to this pasuk. It says like this. Remarkable, amazing thing. Listen to a verse, and then listen to a chazal explain what this verse means. It says like this. V'hoyo beis Esav lekash, beis Yaakov esh, beis Yosef lehavo. That's what it says. What does it mean? V'hoyo beis Esav, bet Esav lekash, the house of Esav is straw, will be straw, straw, hay. Beis Yaakov, bet Yaakov esh, the house of Jacob will be fire, beis Yosef lehavo, bet Yosef lehava. The house of Joseph will be a flame. That's what it says. Esav will be straw, Jacob will be fire, and Joseph will be a flame. But that's what the pasuk says. What's going on? Midrash says this. Listen to the Midrash. Midrash says, you know what that pasuk means? It means like this. This is how the Midrash explains the pasuk. I don't know what that pasuk means to you, but listen to the Midrash. There was a marketplace. You know what the Midrash says? Shuk. Marketplace. In that marketplace was a small pechami. You know what's a pechami? Pechami is a man who sells charcoal. He sells little glowing coals that you can take home and start your fire with. That's what he does. In the old ancient marketplace, that's what he did. He sat there, had a little brazier, he heated up little charcoals, coals, glowing coals, and you came and you took home the coals and you started your fire. That's what he sold. And he stood there, he sat there in the marketplace with his little brazier, and he had his little glowing coals. That's what he did. Suddenly arrived a new arrival in the marketplace, a straw merchant. And he arrived with bales of straw. And he started piling in the straw. And he started filling his place with straw till it overflowed. Until it filled the marketplace. There was no place to move. The customers couldn't get in. There was no place to breathe. The marketplace was getting flooded with tons and tons of straw. You know why? Because straw is only valuable when it's in great quantities. You can't sell a stick of straw. A bucket, a barrel, a bushel of straw is worthless. You follow me? Straw's only got value when it's in large quantities. So you want to make a profit on straw, you have to have a lot of it. So this man started piling in the straw. And the pechami got terrified. He was being swamped out. He couldn't breathe. Couldn't breathe. No air even left for his fire. Nothing left for him. And he started to panic. I'm not finished the Midrash, but let's understand at this point what it means. Beis Esav Lakash, the house of Esav is going to be for straw. When the final truth is revealed in the world, you'll see that that external world that they hype up so much, you're going to see that at best it's going to be straw. The reason that they make so much of it is because to them, the only value they have is in quantity. The thing doesn't have any value in its intrinsic nature. The only way they can make anything out of it is in terms of quantity. You know where the source is. You know where this Midrash comes from. You know where this Pasuk and this Midrash come from. I'm sure it doesn't take me more than 2 seconds for you to identify the place. In Chumash Bereishis, when Esav meets Yaakov, when the two worlds meet, that's a premonition, an augur of the final meeting between Yaakov and Esav, right? And the final cosmic global explosion is going to take place. When the two of them met, what happened? What happened when the two of them met? Esav's coming towards Yaakov to kill him. Yaakov's trying to defend himself against being killed. And at the critical moment of meeting, what happens? Yaakov sends gifts to Esav. He tries to impress him, to buy him off with gifts, physical gifts, wealthy, spectacular gifts. Why? Because that's Esav. That's what Esav wants in the world. So he sends him rich gifts. Esav says, I don't want your gifts. I've got too much. I don't need. What can your gifts add to me? What does he say to his brother? I don't need your gifts, Achi, my brother. Ki yesh li rov. I've got much. I've got so much, I don't need your gifts. What does Yaakov answer? Please take it. Ki yesh li, v'chi yesh li kol. I have everything. You know what the difference is between much and everything? You know what the difference is? Everything. That's what the difference is. Because when you've got much, you haven't got enough. When you've got much and what you want is much, when what you want is muchness and more, you never have enough. No matter how much you have, you always want more. So Esav, his whole criterion, the way he looks at the world is how much he has. So when he meets Yaakov, he says to him, don't worry, I've got plenty. You can't add to me. I've got so much. I've got 400 men with me and I've got armies and I control the world. I've got plenty. Tanks and guns, that's what he meant. Tanks, guns, world power, technology. I've got everything there is in the world. You follow me? I got so much muscle, so much bulk, that you can't add to me. Yaakov says to him, I haven't got much, but I have everything. You know what Yaakov means? I'm the smallest person around. The Jewish people are, you know, it says that Hashem loves us because we're the smallest nation on earth. So the non-thinking Jew, thinks like a non-Jew, thinks that Hashem loves us. You know why? Because we're small, never. So you've got pity on us. You follow me, the underdog, we're so small, they're so big. That's not what it means. It means that you're a six-year-old and it's true. But it means much more than that. He loves us because we're small. When you're small, when you're tiny, when you approach infinity, your value is intrinsic. Your value isn't because... Listen to what the Midrash continues. The Midrash says like this. When the straw started to fill the marketplace, and there was no place to move, and the pechami was being crowded out, and it was beginning to suffocate, and it was beginning to panic, and it means it literally, panic, real panic in there. The muscle and the tanks, and the bulk, and the power, it's for real. It may be straw, but it weighs tons. The tanks are real. You follow? No one said it's an illusion. Straw is real. When the tanks come against us, there'll be panic. There's no question about it. And the pechami started to panic. So it says, Hayasham pikeach echad. There was one wise man present. And he said to the pechami the following thing. What's your panic? What's your problem? When he puts in enough straw, one tiny piece of straw of his is going to touch one of your coals. And you know what will happen? In an instant, he won't be there. Do you know how long it'll take all that straw to disappear? It'll make a hot fire. A very hot fire. It'll spread like wildfire through the straw. But in 2 seconds, he won't be here. You'll be left and he won't be here. The difference between straw and a fire is that straw's only got any value when it's a lot. But a fire makes no difference how much. One spark is the same thing as all the fire in the world. It makes no difference. The value of fire is in its minutest particle. That's what fire is. You follow? One tiny spark burnt all the wood in the world. If you could put all the wood in the world, all the tonnage of inflammable material in the world together, you just need one spark. It doesn't take two sparks. The smallest spark in the world will take care of it all instantaneously. You get the message? That's what a Jew is supposed to be. That's what a Jew is about. They got bulk. There's no question about it. They got power, tonnage, muscle. But it's only straw. The more they have, the more it's going to burn. You follow? When it touches that spark, that's what a Jew is. One last dying ember of the last dying Jew. That's all it's going to take. But when they finally squeeze to that point that the coattail of their straw touches that last dying spark of that last half-alive Jew and disappears instantaneously. That's what it means that Hashem loves us because we're small. You follow? He loves us because our value's in smallness. That's what fire means. That's what fire means. When the lehavat, the flame of Joseph or Yosef, goes out from the Eish of Yaakov and it reaches into the Kash of Esav, it's going to be a hot fire, but it's going to be over. What it means for us, of course, is that, you follow, that only applies while the spark, while the fire is a fire. The fire has to be a fire. It doesn't have to be big. Follow me. It doesn't have to be big, but it has to be a fire. The quantity is irrelevant, but you've got to be alive as a fire. Okay? Nobody said it has to be big. It has to have muscle and bulk, but you've got to be burning.